This episode is brought to you by The Smell of Flowers and Real Spring, finally. Welcome back, everybody, to My Fave Court Chemist. I'm your host, Geraldo.
And I'm Beck. We are so heartbroken by the current situation regarding Roe v. Wade. Abortion is healthcare, and no one should be denied of this. Be sure to go out and support your local reproductive health clinics. They need our support today and every day. With that, here's our show. Hello, everybody. Today, we are very excited to introduce y'all to an incredible chemist. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name is Camille Bishop. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm originally from Midland, Michigan. I did my undergrad BS in chemistry at the University of Chicago. About halfway through, I started working at what was then the brand new Institute for Molecular Engineering with Paul Neely, who had recently come down from University of Wisconsin. That research involved using liquid crystalline polymers, which got me involved in more material science and soft matter. So then I started my PhD at Wisconsin in chemistry. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but on a lot of recommendations, I spoke with Mark Ettinger. And he convinced me to look into small molecule vapor deposited glasses. They were really interested. So I did my PhD with him. And then a lot of that work involved X-ray characterization, which led my interest towards my current postdoc at NIST. And so now I'm using soft X-ray methods to look at amorphous materials, so non-crystalline materials. The soft X-ray methods can do X-ray scattering on materials with chemical and bond specificity. So in contrast to traditional hard X-ray scattering, which is what most people are familiar with. So those X-rays are very high energy. They scatter just off of electrons. And so by using the soft X-rays, they have energies that will excite a 1s core electron up to an antibonding molecular orbital. So then you're sensitive to, the specific chemical identity of the bond as well as its orientation. So I'm working on a team to help develop those methods, and I'm looking at two-component glasses as well as semicrystalline polymers.
That is so mind-blowing as an organic chemist, how you can very specifically target something that seems so abstract, like a, you know, like an orbital. It definitely is not abstract, but it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things that when I started finding out about these methods, like near the end of grad school, it was while I was teaching a gen chem class, and all of a sudden, those MO diagrams mm-hmm. that we make students learn that always seem really abstract, all yes. of a sudden, I saw why they were so important.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's amazing. So, kind of in the same topic, can you tell us about how you first got interested, in chemistry and science, and was it Dow at Midland?
Yeah, exactly. So what's funny, you mentioned that Dow is headquartered in Midland, is maybe very specifically on a rebellious bent. I was very, very adamant growing up that I was absolutely not going to do anything chemistry or science related. I think I decided, I really liked my English classes. I really wanted to, be an English major or something like that. But then in 10th grade, I had a really, really great chemistry teacher. And so he was just super animated, super clear. I did fairly well in it. It finally made me appreciate math. And I don't know, he just made it really interesting. And I just kind of decided from that point on to just go with it and just sort of chugged along. And I guess now I'm here.
Cool. Very, very interesting. Yeah, that's just so crazy that you like just grew up in like where, I only know Midland really because of Dow. And so it's just cool that you like still found your way to chemistry, even though you like didn't think that you ever would.
Yep. Yeah. It's always too, anytime I go home for holidays or anything like that, people there are always like, oh, when are you going to move back here and work for Dow?
Yeah. I guess like most people don't have like a major chemistry, like industrial, like company in their hometown. So you can kind of like never have to deal with those type of questions, but I guess
Would you consider it going back to work at Dow? And this is out of our questions, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, not particularly. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would willingly return to Midland. Also, none of my family is really from there. So my parents are retiring this year, moving back to the Chicago area, which is where my family is.
So. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
So kind of moving along in your academic journey, as you kind of mentioned a little bit about the research that you've worked on over the last few years. So you completed your bachelor's degree in chemistry at the University of Chicago and then moved to UW-Madison for your PhD. Can you kind of walk us through the different experiences that you had at these two different institutions, specifically as someone a part of the LGBTQ community?
Yeah. So both when I was kind of thinking about these questions beforehand, I kind of realized that the common thread is that a lot of my LGBTQ communities that were at both of my institutions were mostly outside of those institutions. So at UChicago, I will say the overall where fun goes to die culture, which is how a lot of people describe University of Chicago, it's got some truth to it. It was a pretty intimidating environment. You know, it's very, very highly competitive. But I really kind of found my space with the women's rugby team. So rugby is traditionally, you know, associated as being a very queer sport, which UChicago's rugby team is no exception. So I really credit the rugby team with kind of where I finally found my group, my confidence. I, you know, ended up being like the captain and coach of the team. And it was also really nice just with that experience. We were part of our league was mostly Chicago schools, one or two Wisconsin schools. And with that, I made queer friends all over the city, which was really nice. And so that also kind of gave me a broader perspective. You know, some people, when you're in spaces that are as competitive as UChicago, I think that you can tend to lose sight of your value as anything other than an academic. And I will say, you know, I've got friends in the chemistry department at UChicago. I don't think any of them are LGBTQ. So I really had to go elsewhere. And then I guess kind of similarly, when I was at Wisconsin, I found most of my queer community at the Madison Gay Hockey Association. So
that's so cool. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, I think our IT person at Wisconsin, like in the chemistry department, he would like really recruit people to join the team. So I joined in my second year. I'd never played hockey before. And then, yeah, it was just like a really good queer community. I ended up also then playing for the UW club team. And once again, found that having friends outside of the chemistry department helped with my overall life balance. And I will say too that while I was in the chemistry department at UW, I definitely do have some queer friends who I met in the department, you know, sprinkled here and there. But there didn't really seem to be LGBTQ community in the department. Although kind of looking, you know, at my Twitter, some of the old email list hosts I'm still on, it does look like, the students there now are making a really good effort and being pretty successful in building a community. So I think that's really great that they're doing that. And I'm excited for that.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes it is like important to not only have a community within like your workplace or like, you know, grad school and like your learning environment, which is, you know, I would hope that for anybody that they could find that community like within those spaces, but also like having just like friends, a life, like just your own kind of community that exists completely outside of the chemistry sphere, I feel like is also really helpful in terms of like creating good like work-life balances. And like you were saying, just kind of creating that balance in grad school. And I feel like both of those things are both like equally as important. It's very hard to build both of those. Sometimes you're lucky if you have like one really strong part of that, but that's really cool that you had those experiences playing really cool queer sports.
It's so cool. I wish I play like, I don't know, rugby or something, but we didn't have that back in Puerto Rico. So I don't know, maybe I could have played baseball, but I don't think there's a gay baseball team or something like that.
This is unrelated, but my partner is starting an MD PhD program at the University of Cincinnati this fall. And so like, I will be moving to Cincinnati whenever I'm done here. Mm-hmm. And I've like already found that there's like a queer kickball league that I'm like 1,000% joining as soon as I move there. Like I've already like looked up like different like queer sports leagues because I've always wanted to do something like that, but they don't, like there's not a lot of options for that in Ann Arbor, but that's just an aside. I know, me too. I'm really bad at it, but like I love it,
so. It's fun. But coming back to the interview, sorry.
Yeah.
So following the journey, you're now a postdoc at NIST, or the National Institute of Standards and Technology, working in polymer chemistry. So can you tell us, you know, why you decided to pursue a postdoc at a national lab, you know, as opposed to like a traditional academic lab? And how has that experience been so far?
Yeah, so the big reason, I will say, I didn't necessarily intentionally choose a national lab over academia. So I will say that the postdoc that I'm in currently, it's still very much sort of an academic style postdoc within a national lab environment. But the primary reason I chose this one is because I believe pretty strongly in following not just science, but people. I think if you work for someone who is a bad mentor or who, you know, you just don't get along with, I feel like you just won't do very good science. So the first reason that I considered the postdoc, so I collaborated with my current advisor, Dean, on some work in grad school. And when I was working on that project, so one of his postdocs at the time did some soft x-ray work, and I had to write the experimental section in the paper. Me having never done any of the soft x-ray work, so, you know, I took my best stab at it, wrote a few paragraphs, sent it to him, and he was like, okay, let's talk on the phone about this. So I talked on the phone to him about it, and he just kind of walked me through everything. And, you know, he was just a really, really good teacher. So that combined with the soft x-ray methods that I thought were really, really cool, I decided to ask him, you know, when I was starting to look at postdocs, how could I join your lab? So this was about a year before I was set to graduate. And so he told me about the NRC postdocs and that I should apply to it. So I did that. And then, so I might have, to be honest, I might have looked at other postdocs as well, but I ended up getting my offer for the NRC on March 17th, 2020. And so everything was shutting down. Everything was really uncertain. So basically I had a job in hand and I took,
you were like,
job.
I'm running with it. Like I have this, I'm running with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Having a certain job was very big. Cause yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously academia did recover, but I think people really held off on making any hires for a good 6 months, year. So it worked out really, really well for me. Thankfully.
That's pretty cool. So you like it there? Like how is it working there?
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Government was a little bit slower to return to what you might call normal compared to academia, just from what I've seen. We've really only started to get back into something resembling regular within the last month or two. So it was a little bit rough starting out as well. So I moved out here in October 2020, you know, height of COVID peaking, you know, moved out here alone. There were not really many people in the lab. So it was a little bit rough getting going, but now that the culture is kind of coming back to the institution, it's pretty nice. There's a lot of expertise on the campus. I think the only thing that I'm really not as big of a fan of is living in the suburbs, not my favorite, but the institution itself is wonderful. It's really great. So I'm meeting, you know, a lot of people, getting my hands on a lot of different projects. It's really fast paced and fun.
Very cool.
So kind of jumping a little bit back to your graduate work, as part of your doctoral thesis, you wrote a chapter for communicating research to a non-expert audience as part of the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy Program. Can you tell us a little bit about what your kind of journey was working with this program, and why do you think it's important to develop initiatives like these?
So I guess I started with that program, essentially, you know, they just put flyers in the elevators. My friends and I were all talking about it, we're all writing our theses, so decided to go for it. So the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy is spearheaded by Bassam Shakashiri, who's, I believe, an emeritus professor at UW. And he's incredibly passionate about science outreach. He has a lot of different initiatives. So he's really responsible for, you know, providing the whole infrastructure for this. And so it was a really great process. They had us, you know, take a stab at it, gave us some guidelines, and then paired us with professional editors who really helped us refine the story. Because, you know, as I think it's really important when doing outreach activities to remember that, you know, we are experts in science. As passionate as we can be about outreach, no matter how passionate, we're not experts. There are people who, you know, have degrees and really expertly communicating this. So I think a really good key thing about a lot of Bassam's efforts is that he has professionals who are helping the scientists communicate. So I think that these, you know, these sorts of initiatives are really good because they give you the resources that you can team up with experts and really get your reach a lot further than you could by yourself.
That's really cool. So the program was like, while you were writing your thesis, you worked with like this program to incorporate basically like explaining your research, like your doctoral work, to a non-expert audience, basically.
Yeah. So it was essentially, so it's just another, ends up being just another chapter of your thesis. So kind of in the same way that, you know, with your advisor, while you're writing your dissertation, you set, you know, I'll send you this chapter by this day, this chapter by this day, you know, it was just similar deadlines with the editor of kind of passing it back and forth.
That's so cool. I'm like really interested in kind of like doing a similar thing whenever I like end up writing my thesis, which like still feels like a very like long way away. But I actually like know or like work with someone at the university who has done like a lot of science communication like workshops for grad students. And she was like, when I did my like thesis defense, I had like 2 or 3 minutes like after each kind of like chapter explanation that was like just geared towards like the people in the audience, like my family members and like people who have no background in science, so that they could actually like understand what I had just done like 5 years of a PhD in, which I feel like is so, that's just so cool.
Yeah, it was really nice. And I feel like doing it also gave me a chance to kind of step back and really think about the overall framing of my work. And I think one really important thing that they had us emphasize during it was the sort of personal aspect of it and, you know, how the work really impacted my own life and what I learned and, you know, how I went on the journey from being a non-expert to becoming an expert. Because I think that, you know, all the little details of the science, if you're not in the field, you maybe don't care as much, but I think people connect a lot more with the human element, which is a lot of what they tried to get us to bring forward in our chapters.
Yeah, definitely. So that was kind of going to be like part of my like follow-up question is like, what is something that you really learned about yourself during like the process of going through this program?
Yeah, so I think a big part of it is sort of that, you know, human element. And I think it helped me kind of think. So I'm a very visual person, so it kind of made me think about how I would like, you know, ideas that I don't understand, how I would like those communicated to me. So a really big part of what I did was focused on, you know, making really pretty pictures. And it kind of, you know, it kind of also cemented backwards just the way that my research, which, you know, it's very abstract, what we do, the fine details are really, you know, really easy to get lost in. And it just kind of helped me couch that in my own life and how it does affect what I do on a day-to-day basis.
That's really nice. So cool.
Yeah. And pretty pictures go a long way. Yeah.
Yeah.
They help a lot.
I have like so many thoughts about this, like just the amount of like scientific papers that you read that just have like horrible like chem draws or figures or just like don't really communicate what they're trying to get across in the paper and just makes it like even harder to read and understand. I think like if you have nice figures and nice pictures, like you can do so much with like how you explain your science and communicate it. So
anyway. Yeah, I'm so thankful that my current mentor, he loves using Blender, which is a super, like it's open access. It's, I can't figure out how to use it, but you can make very beautiful videos and animations. Oh. And he just has the most beautiful animations that he lets us use in our presentations. And it just makes the presentations go over so much more smoothly. They're just gorgeous. And they explain the ideas behind the resonant X-ray work so well.
I might write that down. What is it called again?
It's called Blender.
Blender. Okay.
Yeah, I'm also gonna look that up too.
I'm gonna Google that soon after
this. Yeah. I keep saying it's on my to-do list to like really just get into a tutorial and just really get into it. But it makes some beautiful graphics.
Perfect. I'll look into that. So, you know, going along with this, is there any advice, you know, in addition to Blender, advice or tips that you would give, you know, folks that are interested in making the research a little bit more accessible to a general audience?
Yeah, so I think that my main advice, besides sort of the, you know, the pretty pictures as well as including the human element, is really reaching out to people who are outreach specialists, you know, people who have done some real research in the field, because, you know, enthusiasm is important. It's a really, really huge part of the puzzle, but just enthusiasm is not really enough for effective outreach. So I also had the opportunity while I was at Wisconsin, our MRSEC Center, so Materials Research Science and Engineering Center, these big multi-group grants. They had two outreach specialists, Dr. Ann Lynn, Jillian Daniel, and Matt Stillwell, and they were outreach specialists. They helped me develop a bunch of different modules and really gave me the pedagogical skills to communicate to a non-expert audience. So it's finding those experts and teaming up with them, I think, that is really critical.
Yeah, thank you. That's really nice.
So one of the last questions that we have for you is, who is your chemistry or science role model and why? And you are allowed to have more than one answer.
All right, so it's perhaps a very corny answer, but I would say that my science role model really has to be my PhD advisor, Mark Ettinger. He was just a wonderful advisor. I mean, he kind of set me on the current trajectory that I'm on. Small molecule glasses are not really a commonly taught thing in undergraduate chemistry. So I think he really has to do a big job selling it when you first get on campus. But he just did a really good job with sort of, you know, matching me up with a mentor right away, kind of building my confidence. When I went into grad school, I didn't have a huge amount of confidence. But then he really like helped me and other grad students sort of develop a thorough base in the literature and then kind of, you know, let us interact with other PIs, you know, not as just grad students who worked for him, but really let us be our own scientists. And along with that, he was really, really involved in a lot of the department climate efforts and mental health that we had. And I think it's really critical that he did that, especially because, you know, he's an older tenured professor. You know, he has very good job security and, you know, he's been at Wisconsin, I guess, about 35 years. And so him really communicating the department that it's really important to value mental health, value equity, value diversity. And he really just kind of threw himself into those efforts. And so I think that, you know, people like him stepping up and really helping to do that work along with the people who traditionally end up doing that work. You know, he was just a really good role model, and he's given me a lot of philosophies that I hope to carry forward in my future career as a mentor.
We stand PIs that advocate for mental health. Yeah, we love that.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
So our last question, where can people follow you on social media if they want to connect with you?
Yes. So my main science social media, perhaps my only one that I really use a lot, just my Twitter. So my Twitter handle is GlassicCam. So that's Glassic with a G. So GlassicCam.
Perfect. I'm a little scared because you see that Elon Musk is trying to buy Twitter.
So I saw that he did buy Twitter.
Oh,
so,
really? Yeah, it was actually sold already.
Yeah, I think I saw the news today that it happened.
Yeah, so right before I got on this, I was like, oh man, I'm gonna give them my Twitter handle, and I don't know if I'm still gonna be there in a month.
I know, but now I'm like, what the heck are we even supposed to do?
Yeah, because like we built a community and network using Twitter, and so now it's gonna be like a little bit shaky to use. We'll see how it goes in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, like, what, are we all going to transfer back over to Tumblr or something like that? We just have to do a mass professional move to...
Or Reddit. We can all move to Reddit.
Chemistry Tumblr.
Or the actual social media LinkedIn that's supposed to be used for that.
I don't know about that.
Well, thank you so much for talking
to me. Yeah, it was great. It was great having you on our show. It was nice talking to you. And thank you so much for sharing kind of what you've been up to. And
yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to meet you both.
Yeah, awesome. Likewise. Cool. Well, have a great rest of your evening.
Thanks. You too.
Bye. Right.
Bye.
Bye.
Our hearts are with all of those in Ukraine during this horrific war. We hope for safety and peace for all Ukrainians. Remember to fill out the nomination form on our Twitter if you're interested in being interviewed for the show. You can follow us at MFQCpod. Take care, everybody, and stay safe. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Adios.